But I'm not sure that humans were built to go receive the energy from 30,000 screaming people.
Right.
And then walk off and get in a bunk on a bus and be able to recover. That's a lot of power and a lot of energy that you receive that you need to figure out how to discharge.
This month on Ebb and Flow, we speak with the manager of some of the biggest talents in music. Michael McDonald's professional journey began selling t-shirts on the road for a then relatively unknown Dave Matthews Band. He toured with and helped manage that act for 7 years, learning the trade before co-founding a record label and then his own artist management company. That company, Mick Management, now counts among its clients talented performers such as Walk the Moon, Leon Bridges, Carly Rae Jepsen, David Gray, Mandy Moore, Maisie Stella, and John Batiste, among many others. In our conversation, Michael shares the story of his first big break and also describes aspects of his work, including the complex dynamic between manager and artist, the forces changing the music industry, and the heavy psychological burdens on performers today. I'm Paul Leeming, and on behalf of my partners Tom Lips, Andrew Worthington, Ashley Martella, and Paula Rose, and our entire UBS Long River Wealth Management team of 12, welcome to this month's edition of Ebb and Flow. Michael McDonald, welcome to the podcast. It's so good to be with you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Why don't we start with a little background, Michael? I mentioned some of the highlights in my intro just now, but I wonder if you would describe your career in your own words. If you would, walk us through how you got into this business, how you started working with these talented artists, and how you built your career from there.
I wish there was a master plan at the beginning of it all. I wish I could say that I had this vision for my life, but I can honestly say that I did not. But I was a musician in high school, college, out of college, and you know, was playing in different bands. And I was living in Washington, D.C. Well, my arrival in Washington, D.C. was decided upon with a coin flip. I had a brother living in Washington, D.C. who was going to law school. I had a brother living in Mexico City. And thinking both were interesting, I flipped a coin. And moved to Washington, D.C.
Wow.
That was the first step in my lack of a plan. So I moved to D.C., was playing in an acoustic duo, and met up with a producer named John Alasia, who was a friend of my brother Jack's. And after we had worked together for a while, at some point said, you know, there's this great band that I heard of. They're coming to D.C. We got to go check them out. And that was Dave Matthews Band. And we saw them in this French restaurant, this crazy French restaurant, after hours in D.C., in Georgetown. And I saw them and I heard the songs that Dave was writing, and I thought, you know, I'd given myself 2 years to be a songwriter after college, and I heard what Dave was doing and I thought, I can't do that. I don't understand. It's just not how my brain works. And it was a little painful, but it was also, I consider it one of the biggest blessings in my life, is that I realized what I wasn't good at, or what I wasn't good enough at. And so from that point, I really just thought, all right, I love music. It's what sort of feeds my soul. I won't be on the performing side or the right songwriting side, but I want to figure out how to be involved. And so after going and seeing them on a weekly basis, and becoming friends and working with John. John let me tag along to record their first live album, their first album, which was a live album, which was in Nantucket.
Wow.
It was called Remember Two Things. So I went and did that. The guy who was selling t-shirts, Alex, who's still with them today, had to leave after the summer to go finish college. And so I begged their manager to let me go on the road with them. And my brother and my now wife, who was my girlfriend at the time, said, "Well, you know, we'll cover your student loan payments. Why don't you tell them to go work for free if that'll get it done?" And free labor usually gets you a job.
It does.
So I started selling t-shirts on the road for Dave Matthews in the van in 1993. And I mean, that was my grad school, you know, my PhD. That was, you know, learning from their manager, who's still their manager today, Corn Capshaw, who's one of the great managers, you know, I think, of all time, and a band that was just the hardest working kindest group of people you could imagine. That's where I went from a van to, over the course of 7 years, private planes and stadiums. And it was the time of my life. It was the excitement of, obviously, you know, playing for more and more people, but just absolutely flying by the seat of my pants in terms of just trying to keep up with the growth and all the changes, you know, that came with career growth. So I started as a, you know, selling t-shirts, and because I played guitar, I became the guitar tech. And then because, you know, no one else wanted to do it, I started tour managing and sort of keep accounting as we were on the road. And so as things grew, I wound up, you know, we brought in the guitar tech. Alex finished school. He came back to do all the merchandise. Okay. So I was able to focus on tour managing for about the last 6 years. And that involved everything from, you know, their manager made the decisions and, you know, I made the schedule and got the band where they needed to be on time and dealt with guests and, you know, press and all that stuff. So it was, to be able to see the business from that side was invaluable. And right. to make, you know, best friends of my life and lifelong relationships, that was the first, that was my entree into the business, which was absolutely a blessed period. But I also realized I didn't want to do that for life. And so I talked to Dave and Corin and said, hey, I think I want to get off the road. We collectively decided to start a record label with another guy named Chris Pacelli, who was working in the office for mm-hmm. Corin. So we started ATL Records, and a philosophy of there is amazing music out there, great artists, but the major label system just doesn't always have the time to focus
right.
and, you know, take the time to nurture that music that's necessary. And we used the name David Gray as just a placekeeper in all of our conversations about it. It was just, he was sort of the example of someone that we knew who was incredible, who we thought should be huge, but just, you know, the major label system never worked for him.
Falling through the cracks, yeah, yeah.
And so, as chance would have it, our publicist, Ambrosia, at the time called and said, you know, she was as in love with David Gray as we were, and she said, you know, David has this album that he put out himself, and it's in Ireland, and it's doing really well. And so we called his manager and said, hey, we want to put his record out here, this record White Ladder. And so that was the first thing that we put out, and it started in a spare bedroom of mine in New York, and it exploded, you know, and after about a year, we felt like we needed to bring in that major label to help really blow it up, which is what they do best. And so we partnered with them and then, you know, went on to grow the label. And at about the same time I was doing David Gray, my friend John, who had introduced me to David, introduced me to this young kid named John Mayer, who was looking for a manager. And so I started managing him at the same time. And both things kind of blew up. And so it was another period in my life where I was just flying by the seat of my pants. I was learning everything as quickly as I possibly could, wow. you know, just focused on taking what I had learned on the road with Dave and, you know, using that to help enhance what I was learning on the label and on the artist management side of things. Yeah. So it was very, I don't know. I was on three rocket ships pretty early on in my career.
I'm beginning to understand how you couldn't have mapped this out in the very beginning at the moment of that coin toss.
Right.
I have so many questions and so little time, but I have to ask this one. Do you still have any of the t-shirts you were selling back in 1993?
Yeah, of course.
You are good.
Of course I do.
Good.
I have, in fact, I think we're due for a basement clean out soon, and I'm sure I'll come across them. And they will make the cut. They won't wind up in the dumpster.
Good. Yes. Hold on to those. And the other follow on question is, do you still play the guitar? As you know, you realize you maybe wouldn't be selling records, but I hope you still do it for fun.
Yeah. I do a little bit. Fortunately, two of my girls play guitar, so I'm able to, I've given them, you know, my electric guitar from high school. One of them prefers electric, one prefers acoustic, so they have guitars. And now that they're laying around their bedroom, the guitars are laying around their bedrooms, I go in and pick them up every now and again.
That's amazing. Well, Michael, so for those listening and I'll say moderating, who don't fully understand the role of a music manager, I mean, I know you just sort of described, you know, your early days and what you were working on, but what does the day today look like? And what would you say are the most important aspects of the role of a music manager?
The easiest way for me to describe it is that we are the CEO of an artist's company. Or we are the hub of a wheel. And so we, you know, essentially the artist has a vision, and so we strategize how we want to get there. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we bring in the partners to do that. You know, usually the partners are coming to us because there's some awareness about the artist and they want to be involved. And so, you know, the main players in an artist's career are the manager, and then oftentimes a record label, a publisher, an agent, mm-hmm. and an attorney, and a business manager. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's kind of the executive suite, and we would be, you know, the artist is the chairman, and we work for the chairman. Mm-hmm. And we, you know, but, you know, the way I try and set things up and where I think artists flourish is where the manager is able to, well, where I can keep them in their creative space for as much of the day as possible.
Interesting.
And so that doesn't mean they're always in the studio, but just for most artists, they're not, you know, we're the linear thinker of the team.
Right.
And they should be abstract thinkers and jump from idea to idea rapidly and that's what they should be doing. I don't want them to have to worry about the details of the business of their life.
Right.
You know, to the extent that they, obviously they're welcome to get engaged as engaged as they want, but most are very, you know, big thinkers, abstract thinkers, and that's why they hire a manager, is to do their, is to look after the business side of things. So what we're doing is, artist says, yeah, I'm feeling like I'm ready to go into the studio. So, you know, we'll work with the label or we'll work with the manager to bring in the team to make that record. And then as that record's being made, we'll say, all right, well, we're going to go on tour when the record comes out. So we'll start talking to the agent about putting a tour together. The agent will negotiate deals with promoters. We'll work with the agents to, you know, to book the right rooms in the right markets in the right parts of the world.
Right.
Lawyers papering everything. The business manager, we're budgeting, running projections on the tour, on the record, how much the record's going to cost to make. So it's, we're doing a lot of the contract negotiation, transacting, and really just allowing the artist to focus on making the best art that they can.
And does that ever create a conflict? I was actually going to ask you about this in my next question, which is just sort of what the dynamic is between, you know, someone in a business role and a management role like you and someone in a purely creative role. I mean, you know, when you're trying to keep them creative and you're trying to keep everything organized, does that create moments of stress in the relationship with your clients?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
And in any business, the best relationships are built on trust.
Right.
And, you know, if that artist trusts that you're trying to execute their vision with as much integrity as they expect, but looking out on the business side to make sure that they're compensated correctly, you know, if those things are aligned, things run smoothly. Now, there are certainly moments where artists don't want to do certain things to promote their work. Sometimes they feel like, you know, it's just a little bit too exploitive or that's not really true to their brand. And so there are, you know, certainly conversations, and ultimately it's going to be their decision. Right? It's their life. It's their career. I'm just trying to put opportunities in front of them that enhance that and that move the vision forward. But there are certainly moments of, you know, hey, I worked really hard to get you this opportunity. And they say, that doesn't feel right. And, you know, you debate it and, you know, either way, it either happens or it doesn't. And, you know, as, you know, if I really have to make the case to get something done, I need to have vetted it thoroughly and know that it's pretty locked down before I'm going to push my client to do it.
Right. Well, it's funny as you describe this. I'm seeing the parallels between your profession in music management and mine in wealth management. It is all built on trust. Michael, let me ask you this, and then we'll move on. But this interview that we're having right now, we moved a couple times, you know, because your schedule's fluid, and you know, you had to head out to the Emmys earlier this week or this weekend. And if you kind of believe the movie depictions of the life of a rock star or a professional musician or an artist, it's a wild ride, right? I mean, long days, longer nights, a lot of travel, unpredictability. And I know work-life balance is tough in any job, but is it particularly challenging to balance your personal life as a father and a husband with the expectations of the professional artists you manage?
It is. I think, you know, one of the things that I guess I can call it a luxury, or it's just been my philosophy from the start, is that I've been able to be in business with people that I actually like.
Right.
And that's part of the equation when I'm going to work with someone is, you know, is this, are our values, I guess, somewhat aligned in that everyone understands that I have a family. And if a client's not going to understand that, you know, I may have to take a call during my daughter's soccer game, or I may have to push a call during my daughter's soccer game. I'm not sure that's who I want to be in business with. Now, I certainly have moved things around for my family, you know, to accommodate clients. I mean, it is a business and it is my job. But, you know, there's a point at which I'm going to prioritize my family. But the flip side of it is, I was just thinking about it recently. You know, the number of red eyes that I've taken so that I could be there for a first day of school, or to be there when the kids wake up, or the number of 6 a.m. flights that I've gotten on from in L.A. to make sure I get back in time to help pick the kids up or that sort of thing are countless. And it requires, you know, the kids are kind of raised in it, so
right.
It's their normal. Fortunately, my wife, Becky, was in the music business before we started having kids, so she knows the schedule. You know, but I've tried to make it as much, it's just such not a job, that it's a lifestyle. And so, you know, when the kids were little, we would get a bus and go on the road, you know, and tour with acts. And, you know, we'd bring other families along so the kids had fun and I could, you know, do my job and be with my family and, you know, have a little adventure at the same time. You know, and now my kids are old enough where they, you know, most, now it's okay for them to hang out with me for, you know, early teens, they didn't want to be seen with me.
Right.
But, you know, now they certainly have logged plenty of hours at shows with me because, you know, I wanted them to be a part of it and they want to be a part of it. But it's a constant struggle and it's something that I really prioritize.
Yeah.
But it requires, you know, a lot of understanding from your spouse and your kids, and then a lot of crazy scheduling
right
on our part
to make it work.
Yeah.
So, Michael, I think I'd be remiss not to bring up COVID-19. It's an important subject and one that I suspect has sort of changed the game in your industry, particularly as it relates to live music and tours last year. So what was your experience from your front row, or I guess your backstage vantage point?
In short, it was horrible.
Yeah.
Overnight, we knew things, you know, the business stopped for an unknown period. And, you know, in March and April, we thought, okay, you know, it looks like at least the summer is going to be safe. That's my dog snoring in the background.
mine will chime in soon, too, so no worries.
Right. So, you know, we again, everyone, no one knew what was going to happen and how long this was going to be upended. So, you know, at first we thought, all right, well, outdoors this summer should be okay. And then it quickly became summer's not happening. Hopefully by, what we were watching closely was sports.
Right.
And so what was, you know, because there are enough parallels to think, all right, if the NBA goes back, then arenas will be back, right? Arena concerts will be back. Well, obviously the NBA came back the way they came back. And there's no way you can have a concert in an arena without fans. So, but so then it was, we were moving tours. You know, the first, I don't know, 4 months was just spent rerouting tours. Right. So if you had a tour that was supposed to play last summer, all right, I'm going to move it to next February. Well, we can't, you know, so now we're trying to move it indoors. Oh, actually, February is not going to happen. Let's move it to next summer. So you move it to next summer. And then all your dates that were going to happen in the fall, all right, well, let's move those to March. Oh, wait, March isn't going to happen. Let's move them to next November. So you can only imagine, for one, it was what was keeping us busy.
Right.
And keeping our minds occupied and giving us something, feeling like we had some purpose. That was in addition to, you know, just trying to keep our artists updated with what the heck was going on.
Right.
I had artists in the studio who all of a sudden we had to just change the way that they had always recorded. So we couldn't all go in the studio. They lived in four different cities. So suddenly, you know, this technology that was sort of used in the past became a necessity, where our producer in L.A. take over your computer in Cincinnati, Ohio, and you would play guitar into your, you know, Pro Tools, which is an audio software, into your computer. He was listening in L.A. You know, he'd say, all right, that was a good take. Let's do it again. All the while with the band, the rest of the band, watching you on Zoom. So it was, so that's how you had, instead of all being in one room, that's what it became, these virtual studios. Mm. And it took a lot longer. But again, it kept everyone creative and occupied and moving forward. And, you know, fast forward to now, you know, we had a really, I think, successful touring summer. Outdoors proved to be pretty safe. We're moving indoors now. You know, vaccinations are becoming mandatory to go to shows and for bands to enter clubs. But the protocol that everyone from, you know, we have clients in clubs and we have clients doing the Emmys, the COVID protocol that everyone has had to generate for their size crew, you know, it changes every day, and it's really, really labor intensive. And, you know, a pretty decent financial undertaking as well.
Right.
And it's, you know, it's just difficult to, sometimes it's difficult to reach consensus within the band.
Right.
But then also just to be able, there is no, all right, if you do this, this is definitely going to happen.
Right.
I mean, you can bubble all you want, but someone's walking in and out of a hotel.
Right.
And someone has a chance of getting COVID.
Right.
And so there are no guarantees. You can only try and minimize, you know, your exposure. And so it's definitely, you're just hoping your tours play
right
at this point.
Wow.
And, you know, we're always learning more and we're always getting better at it, but it's a whole other layer of work that we've never had to deal with.
Well, you so far weathered the storm, and I commend you. And that's amazing ability to adapt that we've seen across so many industries, and including yours. So let me ask you this: I'm curious, beyond COVID, how has the industry changed since you've been involved, and where do you see things going from here? I know that's a tough question, but sort of in the big picture, what's changing the most?
What has changed the most is the power dynamic of the industry, which is, in some respects, from the record labels to the promoters, because live music has become so much more of a force in an artist's career. But also, the artist holds a lot more power than they used to. And largely because of social media, the onus of marketing an album and a tour falls on the artist. So, you know, it's why you're seeing and why we're preparing, you know, building infrastructure for our clients to release their own music. The record labels are never going to go away. They shouldn't. They do, you know, they do. The superstars of the world need a record label and that infrastructure. But there's more artists who, you know, it's not only viable, it's actually probably more profitable for them to do things on their own. Hmm. So I think the power has really shifted into the hands of the artist because of social media. And if you really, really work that, you can control your own destiny a lot more.
So, Michael, I'm jumping around a little bit here, but I wanted to touch on this because, you know, I noted as I was, you know, reading more of your biography, some of the work you've done, some important work you've done in the nonprofit area within your industry, in particular, you know, your role as chairman emeritus of Music Cares and involvement in other organizations. But what are some of the issues you're working to address right now in the industry?
The biggest issue I think we're facing right now is, and fortunately, because more and more people are talking about it, is mental health. Mm-hmm. And that falls, you know, that includes addiction and recovery, as well as just general mental health and well-being. You know, Music Cares is the organization that I've put most of my energy into. They've been around for a long time. They help musicians, whether it's replacing instruments after earthquakes or, you know, hurricanes, or you know, helping people with rehab or paying for someone's rent when they break their arm. It's a catch-all, and it's an incredible service. And, you know, in COVID, we gave away about $30 million just to help people, help artists, you know, buy groceries or pay the rent or whatever they needed while the industry was shut down. But I think there's a mental health component that people are talking about, and, you know, in entertainment and sports and just across around all industries, that I think is a really healthy conversation to be having. And it's just about the stresses the increased stresses that we're all bearing. And so whether that's, you know, people turning to drugs and alcohol to cope with those things, or just, you know, like we've seen some athletes do, just not being able to compete at the level that they have to.
Right, or choosing not to because they'd rather not, you know. Yeah.
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 So I think it's a really healthy conversation. It's important. I'm thrilled to be a part of it and be, you know, part of the solution. And, you know, I'm happy that these things are coming to light a little bit more than they ever have. Because it's just the world of, you know, the sex, drugs, rock and roll is, you know, there are certainly elements of that there, but it's a lot more boring backstage than most people would ever think. And, you know, I think it's just becoming a healthier environment. And I think part of that, the result of that is going to be healthier mindsets as we go out and, you know, do things that aren't, you know, it's not, you know, the human, I'm not sure that humans were built to go receive the energy from 30,000 screaming people.
Right. Right.
And then walk off and, you know, get in a bunk on a bus and be able to recover, you know, like that's a lot of power and a lot of energy that you receive that you need to figure out how to discharge. And finding healthy ways to do that is a great thing.
It's a fascinating aspect of this business and of professional sports and so many other areas where one is expected to perform at the highest level and expected by so many fans to do that every time they get out there. I mean, as an amateur pianist, having played in a couple of recitals and, you know, shaking in my piano bench, I can only imagine what that is like times hundreds of thousands. So it's
top of it, you're supposed to also have a perfect life that looks good on Instagram, and you should have smart, witty things to say on Twitter,
right,
and you should be able to represent your personal brand flawlessly.
Yeah.
I mean, so there's all these things that are on top of all the pressures that, you know, used to just be being on the cover of Rolling Stone.
Right.
There's a whole new host of pressures that these, you know, that artists have to deal with.
Well, it's good to hear that people like you are working on that issue. That is a very worthy cause. So, Michael, last question, and I'm just going to admit it. This is cliche, but I'm hoping you'd share a favorite anecdote from your years in the business. You know, sort of the story you dine out on. Is there one memory that stands out from others?
I think, you know, one of my favorite periods of time, I guess, was toward the end of, you know, my run with Dave Matthews Band was, you know, this, we ended with, That's Mile High Stadium and a couple of Giant stadiums and a Foxborough Stadium. And, you know, that was obviously it doesn't get any bigger than stadiums. And I remember the we got an escort from downtown Boston out to Foxborough, and so we were on the bus and driving along, and I walked up front to sit with the driver, and I looked, and there were no cars in front of us, and it looked really, it looked like, you know, the end of the world. There were literally no cars on the highway in front of us, and then I told the guys, I was like, check this out, and we looked behind us, there were no cars behind us. We were the only, you know, there were three buses on the highway, and there was nothing around us. And then what we would see is police motorcycles flying by us. And what we realized is they were blocking exits ahead of us and then sort of leapfrogging each other. So that there was, and it was, I mean, I've, you know, this probably happens for presidents all the time. I just had never been in a vehicle that it was,
nor was being done.
But it was just, and I think the cops looked like they were having a blast, right? Because they, you know, it's probably fun for them to do. But just the idea of just having your own highway, it was such a rock star moment that, you know, it was, I appreciate the Massachusetts State Police tremendously. And, you know, we got from downtown to Foxborough in about 15 minutes.
Probably broke a record there, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But it was remarkable to see these guys just, it's, you know, you can shut down a highway if you really, really want to.
Well, we look forward to reading that story and others when you get around to publishing your memoirs down the road. We'll make that announcement here today.
Absolutely,
Michael McDonald. Thank you so much for sharing this these stories of your career. So, congratulations on all that you've done and on your continued work. And we look forward to speaking with you again sometime soon.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Paul. I appreciate it.